I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's the 17th of April, 9 a.m., 2007. With me is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Huggins, Senator Olson, Senator Dyson, Senator Thomas, and Senator Elton. Today we're going to have a fairly full agenda. We're going to try to take care of a few bills, four of them. First, we're going to bring up Senate Bill 89, electronic monitoring of gangs on probationers. And then we're going to move to House Bill 168, dealing with land transfers between the Alaska Railroad and the Department of Transportation. And we're going to go on to Senate Bill 100, updating some of the substance abuse and mental health program statutes. And then we're going to finish up with Senate Bill 76, setting up tuition savings accounts for foster children. And in the event that the calendar gets away from us today, or the clock gets away from us, we will pick up where we leave off today, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., finish up, and then start the capital budget review as presented by the governor. With that, we've had two hearings on Senate Bill 89, the electronic monitoring and gang probationers. The intent here is to go ahead and move the bill from committee unless there's some issues that surface here. Yesterday we heard the bill, and there was some adjustments needed on the fiscal note, and the sponsor thought that it would be best to go ahead and hold it over and let him get the fiscal note scrubbed up, which has been done. And with that, I'd like to have the sponsor and possibly the Department of Corrections come forward if they have a representative in the audience here. We're not going to take any more public testimony on the bill. What I would like to do is have the sponsor and the department spin us up on the fiscal note changes, and then we'll take some action.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Wilkowski. I'm the senator for Northeast Anchorage. And there was a little bit of confusion on the fiscal note. Yesterday morning, we got word that there would be a new fiscal note. And I'm happy to report that the new fiscal note actually has a zero fiscal note for fiscal year 2008. And then the remainder of the expected cost has been expanded out in 2009 through 2011. I can let the Department of Corrections speak a little bit more in detail on that.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dwayne Peoples, Department of Corrections. You see before you a revised fiscal note as of yesterday. The department feels that there is a substantial pool in the future of people out there that may qualify for this type of electronic monitoring, and that getting people convicted to or part of their sentencing under the Blakely decision in the courts will provide some sort of hurdle and will slow down people coming into this probation program. We think the absolute earliest we would see anybody would be maybe the last quarter of next fiscal year, FY08, and probably not see anybody coming into the program until early FY09. Based on that assumption, we have put a zero for FY08. If we get a big influx, which we really, really doubt, we will report that to our finance co-chairmans. But at this point in time, if there's a couple that show up, we will incorporate them into our normal intensive supervision and surveillance probation program.
Okay. And then can you please address FY 2012 and 2013 that's reflected here on the...
The program that we have designed in this fiscal note would be about a 1-to-40 ratio. Currently in our own intensive supervision program, we have maybe 36 to 40 people that would probably qualify under this sentencing program. And so at this point in time, we projected out that we would gradually grow up to about the 40 over a three-year period. For 012 and 013, we are submitting an indeterminate note because we just do not know where the Department of Law or what the courts or what the police departments are going to pressure. So we're basing a 40, the number 40, on our current anticipated caseload.
Okay. Senator Dyson.
Thank you, Dwayne. My memory serves me in the past with some categories of prisoners. We've been able to force them to pay for the monitoring devices and or go after their permanent fund or something. Can you refresh my memory on all that?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson. There's probably two things you're remembering. In the 80s, there was some statutes to have probationers pay for their probation services. That was sort of a bust and did not work. Those statutes, I believe, were later rescinded from the books. We currently have an electronic monitoring program for sentenced prisoners on furlough, and we do collect money on that part of it. So basically, we're trying to charge about $17 a day, and we're getting some collections on that. Provides most of our contract fees.
If I may continue.
Yes, go ahead.
So with these people that we're talking about in this bill, will we be able to collect from them?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, yes. There is an amendment, CS has been proposed, that would give us the authority to collect for probationers under this program.
All right. And just finally, you mentioned some decision that that affected how we deal with this stuff. Can you summarize that for me quickly?
Through the chair to Senator Dyson, there was a court appeal, and it's called the Blakely decision, where if you are imposing extra standards, this higher level of aggravating factor, you would have to have one, first, the conviction, yeah, and then a second hearing to prove the circumstances for the higher level surveillance under probation. Right. So it's a two-step process. Yep. It is a higher level that must be achieved by the prosecutor, the jury, and the courts.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Senator Hoffman, may we have a motion, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee substitute for Senate Bill 89, Finance Version L, move from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes 1, 2, 3, and 4, and a forthcoming revised Finance Committee fiscal note from the Department of Corrections. Or is that's the one that we received?
That's the one we received.
That's the one we received.
Right, that's the one we received. We have a motion on the table to move the bill. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move SB 89 from committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note. We'll have a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Thank you. We're going to now hear Senate Bill 168. And this is the first hearing on this particular bill. The intent here is to go ahead and move the bill unless there's some issue that shows up through the review of it. This is a House companion bill for Senate Bill 137, which we have in committee but have not heard. With us today is Mr. David Scott from Representative Kyle Johansson, the sponsor of the bill. And if you could go ahead and walk us through this bill and explain the benefit to the state, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Scott, Staff Director of Johansson. House Bill 168 authorizes two exchanges of land between the Alaska Railroad Corporation and the Department of Transportation. House Bill 168, it accommodates two DOT projects. One project is the widening and lane improvement of the Parks Highway in Wasilla. The second is the construction of a heavy aircraft cargo apron at the Fairbanks International Airport. Both of these projects, Mr. Chairman, require the realignment of the railroad's track and right-of-way lands. This legislation ensures that all the appropriate legal titles to property are in place for so the projects can move forward. The legislative approval is required for the Railroad Corporation to do anything for, to its land, and that is spelled out in AS 4240-285, which requires legislative approval for the railroad to, quote, exchange, donate, sell, or otherwise convey its entire interest in land. This this bill has gone through three committees on the House side. The companion bill has been through the Transportation Committee on the Senate side. There have been no votes against it. There have has two attached, zero fiscal notes.
Does that conclude your presentation?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
May we have a representative from DOT come forward? Yes. If you
Mr.
could please
Chairman,
introduce.
My name is Mary Sirocki, and I'm Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Transportation Public Facilities. This bill is important to the Department of Transportation. When we get the transfer of title, it ensures that we have the best title available and that our funding agencies are happiest when we have the fee simple title. So this helps us ensure that our federal agencies will fund these projects. I have online two people who can answer specific questions about the projects themselves.
Well, first we thought we'd ask you the questions and then
Then
we'll field it to the telephone. If Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To my understanding, this was state land at one time, and it simply it went to the railroad, and now it's going back to the Department of Transportation in this case. Is that
correct?
That correct? Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Do we have a representative in the audience from the railroad? You can identify yourself and who you represent and maybe tell the committee why we should do this.
Good morning. My name is Wendy Linskoog, and I work for the Alaska Railroad Corporation. We're very supportive of this bill. And again, as the representative from DOT mentioned, it really just cleans up title and is a clean way to go as we move forward with these projects. So happy to answer any questions.
Seeing no questions, and looks like a fairly straightforward land exchange and title cleanup bill. Is there anybody from the Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the relocation of the tracks, is that budgeted for the railroad?
If we could have the.
Where are those dollars at for the relocation of the railroad tracks?
For the Parks Highway project?
Yes.
That has already taken place, so that construction is complete.
Could you please identify yourself again for the
record? Excuse me, through the chair, I'm Mary Sirocki again with the Department of Transportation Facilities.
Then if the tracks have been already complete, why is the transfer needed?
When the department began the construction process, we entered into lease arrangements with the department, with the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and this allows us to get the fee simple title where it's available for the land.
Why is the transfer needed then if the lease arrangements would have been adequate and you already accomplished the relocation effort?
It's always in the state's best interest to have fee simple title wherever possible so that we don't have to go back and negotiate a lease at some point in the future. Leases always have a lifespan to them, and going back and negotiating leases is not necessarily in the best interest of the state. We don't have the ability to really move the highway and the railroad back again should lease negotiations not be successful.
So, and then how much was this lease to the state of Alaska?
I don't know what the cost associated with that was. We have folks online who perhaps could answer that question.
Right, let's...
Fran Zimmerman?
Yeah, we have Fran Zimmerman from the Department of Transportation. If you could introduce yourself and who you represent.
Good morning. This is Fran Zimmerman, and I'm with the Central Region Department of Transportation. My involvement in the bill is related to the Parks Highway Project. And the actual instrument that we have in place that enabled the project to go forward is a temporary construction permit. The conditions of that permit are such that it requires that we go through the process we're now in the process of with this legislation to convey the titles that are needed respectively for the railroad and the department to exchange the property. The funding for this was from the Federal Highways Administration.
But we heard testimony here today that the tracks have already been relocated.
Yes, sir. As a part of the Parks Highway project, that was necessary.
And how much was the lease, the past lease for this right-of-way?
Representative Hoffman, or Senator Hoffman, excuse me, through the chair. I don't know the exact amount of the temporary construction permit. I believe it was a nominal fee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Well, Mr. John Bennett, if you're online from the department, do you have any answers to a couple of these questions?
Yes, this is John Bennett. I'm the right-of-way chief for Northern Region DOT, and the project that I represent is the Fairbanks International Airport heavy cargo apron relocation. The we did enter into what we call a right of entry, essentially allows our contractor permission to enter on the right-of-way of the railroad and relocate it in anticipation that we will eventually transfer title. I think we were ready to proceed with the transfer of title the last year during the tail end of the legislative session. There wasn't enough time to do it then, so that's why we entered into the right of entry. The approximate acreage of the what we're giving up in exchange for what the railroad's giving up is essentially equal, and so there's really not going to be an exchange of money for this transaction. And the project will fund through Federal Aviation Funds the actual relocation of the track.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. And the exact amount, is that in acreage that they're equal, or is that in value, dollar value, that they're equal?
Yeah, essentially in acreage is where they're equal, and so the presumption is that in value they're equal. They're actually relatively close together, and so we would be hard-pressed to do a formal appraisal and actually find a difference in value with two properties that close together.
Has there been an appraisal done on these two parcels?
No, there has not.
Is that the standard operating procedure for DOT not to have appraisals when they deal with right-of-ways transfer issues?
No, it would be. It is a standard practice to do an appraisal. But during a land exchange, if the properties we were exchanging were significantly far apart such that we would expect to see different values, we would do an appraisal to ensure that what we were exchanging was essentially of equal value. In this case, that was not necessary.
Do we have any other questions? Phyllis Johnson's online from the Alaska Railroad. Do you have any comments, Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Thank you. No, I'm available to answer questions if there are any of the railroad.
Do you feel that these are valued and equally, and why wouldn't the railroad ask for an appraisal?
Through the chair, the railroad is getting equivalent value in the sense of having an operating route covering the same stretch, you know, from point A to point Z. And so from our perspective, even if the acreages are a little different or the value's a little different, we have the same, we're in the same status quo that we were initially before this happened. We'll be able to if the market picks up. We don't even really run much in the way of traffic out there now, but we are able to in the same manner after this project as we were before, so for us that's equivalent value.
There's two issues before the legislature concerning a railroad land exchanges. Neither one of them have had an appraisal done. Is that the standard operating procedure of the railroad, not to have appraisals?
Through the chair, there are two exchanges, but they are different in that on the DOT one that is before us here, we are dealing with another state entity, number one, so it's not, the land is not even leaving the umbrella of state ownership, just between two different state entities. And as I said, it's as John Bennett said, it's very close by, and so for us, it really is equivalent. It's operationally very equivalent. The other one that's before the legislature is a rather unique land transfer, and so it kind of stands on its own two feet for other reasons other than, you know, an appraised value. Our president has been down there testifying, I think, several times about the setting for that other exchange. I believe you're referring to the Eklutna one. And that it has a wholly different basis for undertaking that one.
Let me ask the question in a little different way. Are those two transactions an anomaly, or is it the standard operating practice of the railroad, or is it a fairly common practice of the railroad not to have appraisals? Or
no, sir. When we do most land transactions, we do appraisals. For example, our leases all require appraisal. And if we were trading land with a private party, for example, rather than DOT, and while we haven't consummated a transaction like this that I recall, we've talked about it a few times, and in those cases where we've talked about it, and if we were to do one with a true arm's length private party, yes, I'm sure we would have appraisals. This would be an anomaly, the situation you're describing here, but that's because we're dealing with another state entity primarily.
Okay, thank you. Do we have anybody in the audience that would like to come forward and speak on this issue? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the committee. Do we have any questions from committee members of the sponsor or the departments? And the desire of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass out House Bill 168 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Thank you. We have a motion on the table to move the bill. I would like to reference that the fiscal notes are, there's two of them, and they're both zero. Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee with individual recommendations, the attached two fiscal notes representing zero. And we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. Thank you. Committee back to order. We're going to have a hearing today on a bill, Senate Bill 100, on substance abuse and mental health programs, issues that are of concern across the state and to this generation and the next. The intent here is to hear the bill today. There'll probably be no action taken today. We're going to have the sponsor come forward here in a minute. Come on up, Senator. Senator Ellis. Oh, I know. to walk us through the bill. And we have several folks in the audience that are here. There's several folks, two online. So we'll just kind of walk through the bill at the pace of the presenter. And with that, Senator Ellis, if the floor is yours.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chairman and members of the committee. I'm very pleased to be here this morning. For the record, I'm Senator Johnny Ellis, downtown and midtown Anchorage. I'm joined by my staffer, Ms. Kate Herring, who's given her life to this bill and the technical details and can help me answer any questions. I'm not going to spend a lot of time and I appreciate your time today, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time covering some of the details and statistics that are in your packets about the enormous human tragedy and negative budget impacts of untreated addiction, substance abuse and addiction across the state of Alaska. The bad statistics are legion, they're depressing, and they're wildly expensive for our state budget. So you probably don't need anything as budget writers from me about the impact on our state budget. Any reasonable person can come to the conclusion that there must be a better way to deal with these issues than what we're doing today. And so Senate Bill 100 before you proposes a significant modernization of our state statutes in this area. The bill's broken into two parts. The first has three elements to it. The most significant is updating our statutes on substance abuse related to a requirement for evidence-based, research-based treatment programs. That is the term, those are the terms of art used by states across the country. Everyone is modernizing their statutes in this way based on the science and the research, largely due to the fact, Mr. Chairman, that many policymakers and budget writers are tired of funding treatment programs that may not work. And so the Department of Health and Social Services is very supportive of this effort to update our statutes to give them the support they need to require evidence-based and research-based treatment programs in the state so we can be assured that we're getting the best result for our dollars invested. I personally would like to see an expansion in the future of treatment programs. This bill does not do that. It simply requires that the programs that we do fund in this area be evidence-based and research-based programming, and then we can be assured that we're doing a good job. A second element of this first part of the bill is a requirement that pregnant women go to the front of the line. In our existing treatment programs, again, not an expansion of our services, but that a requirement, and it's intuitive, it's based on research, that pregnant women go to the front of the line. And Mr. Chairman, the fact is that all these programs have long waiting lists, almost every one of them. It's a frustrating situation. But this language, if adopted, would put pregnant women at the front of the line. I know Senator Dyson's not with us at the moment, but he's been a leader on the issue of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Totally preventable, wildly expensive, tragic human consequences. So if we put pregnant women first, we can hopefully improve those outcomes. And third, for the first part of the bill, is a requirement in state statute that is a non-discrimination clause against faith-based approaches to treatment. We want to make sure that faith-based approaches to treatment, which can be very effective for some people, are as long as they can compete on the same basis of being evidence and research-based, same as the secular programs for treatment in our public facilities, that there would be no discrimination against them. That's very strongly supported, as you can imagine, by the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, a non-discrimination clause. And I provided to Senator Dyson, and I believe to all members of the committee, a legal opinion from Ledge Legal. We also have confirmation from the Attorney General that this is a positive thing. It's constitutional and actually improves our statutes significantly, or protects us from any challenges in the future. The second part of the bill, so those are the free, easy, non-controversial, needed updates to our state statutes. The second part of the bill, Mr. Chairman, is a pilot project, a single pilot project for between 10 and 12 secure beds in detox. Currently, we have on our statutes an involuntary commitment statute that allows judges, upon review of situations for people who have co-occurring mental disorders and substance abuse problems, we're recommending that there be a secure setting for people, for judges to use for involuntary commitment. The existing statute, it's an expensive proposition, relatively expensive. It's about $2 million a year commitment over the next 6 years. That's a big consideration, and once we get through the testimony, I have a proposal for you, something I've discussed with the co-chairs, of a way to approach this for the future. But it is absolutely true that there are a number of people in the state who are just very, very expensive people who cycle through the system at great public expense. These are the people that wind up dead in a snowbank or the suspect at the scene of a murder. They're the most expensive people who cycle through the system, enormous human tragedy, and other states have found a more cost-effective and humane way to deal with this. That's the second half of this bill. There will be some testimony about it, and I have a proposal for you once we get through that. So that's the brief outline of the bill, Mr. Co-Chairman, and I'll end my comments here and get on with the testimony and be respectful of your time. Thank you.
Do we have initial questions for Senator Ellis? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes to the demonstration project. Will that demonstration project, although located in one place, be open to individuals from throughout the state of Alaska that would participate in this demonstration project, or would it be limited to where the project is being administered?
Well, it would be my intent for it to be open, for a judge to involuntarily commit someone before them to this facility from any place in the state. It would be located in a specific area, co-located with existing detox. But these secure beds would be available to, that would be my intent, that they be available to people from around the state. Truth be told, Mr. Co-Chairman, and through the chair to Senator Hoffman, we should be doing this. If I had my druthers, we would try this in an urban setting and we would try this in a rural setting. But anything that we do together in the future should be open to people from across the state. I think we will find a significant demand and a significant cost savings. But my intent comports with Senator Hoffman's.
Thank you. Other initial questions for Senator Ellis? And with that, I'd like to thank Senator Ellis, and we'll bring up some testimony from the audience. If kind of up to you, Senator Ellis, if you want to slide back to the bench or sit there to help answer questions, whatever you guys want to do. That, I'd like to start with Jeff Jesse, the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, starting to be a regular guest at the Senate Finance. Welcome again.
Our old friend.
If you can identify yourself for the record and speak to the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I'm here today to support Senate Bill 100. This is really a significant step forward, both in overall policy for substance abuse treatment, but also taking an innovative approach to really trying to get some push on some of the people that are having the most difficulty overcoming their alcohol addiction. On the policy level, looking at evidence-based practices is something that the Trust has been very supportive of. It's something that we're trying to push the mental health system towards across the board, really looking at the science behind what we do, and rigorously evaluating the results of those programs. That's something that traditionally in mental health we have not done a very adequate job of doing. And I think emphasizing through legislation, the expectation that we are going to use evidence-based practices, that we are going to rigorously evaluate our outcomes, is really crucial in the long run, not only to effectiveness of our programs, but in cost containment. If we're not doing things that are effective, then we need to move the money out of those activities into programs that are effective. Particularly, for example, prioritization of women that are pregnant that have substance abuse problems. This is huge. FAS, FAE is the most preventable mental health condition that we deal with at the Mental Health Trust. It's hugely expensive for every one of those cases. Anything that we can do to get a handle on those problems, I think, is to the good. As to the demonstration project, as I said the other day, my background is in representing people with civil rights and other rights issues for many years. And I have to admit, for a long time, I was pretty set against involuntary commitment and treatment. First of all, I didn't think it worked. And second of all, I really felt it was an infringement on people's liberties. But, I have to say, having spent now going on 28 years in this field and seeing what's happening with these folks and looking at the literature and actually looking at what happens, I've changed my mind. First of all, the evidence is clear from other programs around the country that involuntary treatment and treatment while in corrections is in fact effective. And it does reduce the incidence of abuse when somebody is no longer confined. So first of all, it does work. Second of all, you know, I've gotten to the point where the fact that, many of these people consume so much of our other resources in cycling through emergency rooms and the jails and API and all of our other systems, that frankly, it's just not fair. We need to be more efficient and effective in our use of resources, and that means these people that are high utilizers of these other services frankly need to get a handle put on them. They need to get put into treatment. We need to follow up on that with aftercare, which is something that we'll be looking at working with Senator Ellis and the department on as we move along. But we're very supportive of looking at this for Alaska. There is good data from other jurisdictions that it's effective, and we will certainly participate and collaborate with you in evaluating the results to ensure that you are making the kind of investment that you're hoping to make. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jesse, if this is such a worthwhile program, and why hasn't it not been tried before? And it certainly sounds like it. On its merits, it's something that should have been implemented decades before, because substance abuse and the failure of substance abuse programs in the past has been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Why hasn't there been something like this done before?
Well, through the chairman, Senator Olson, I think partly because of how the two different commitment statutes and structures have evolved. On mental health civil commitments, you're actually committed to the care and custody of the Department of Health and Social Services, the commissioner, and then the state is responsible for providing treatment if you're committed in that way. Our alcohol commitment process has been very different. That's been a process that's initiated by a petition from anyone, and you're actually committed to a facility. You're not committed to the care and custody of the commissioner. And those facilities often aren't capable of the security aspects of that kind of a commitment. And many judges have been reluctant, frankly, to use the state's police power to commit someone to a nonprofit entity. That doesn't seem comfortable to a lot of judges. That's different than the state using its power to commit someone to their own care and custody, like in child custody cases or mental health commitments. So I think partly it's been how the two commitment systems have evolved, and then frankly just our thinking and understanding of addictions and what kind of treatments are effective have evolved. And I think the pendulum is swinging on this issue of civil liberties. I think there are more and more people, frankly like myself, that have come to the conclusion that there has to be a different balance struck. And that we have to hold people more accountable for their behavior, even if we believe it's an addiction that they need to be treated for.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hawke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In looking at these 10 beds, what do we envision the actual time that individuals would be involuntarily committed to, and how many individuals do you anticipate will be served in the course of a year?
For the record, my name is Kate Herring. I am staff to Senator Ellis. Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, somebody can be involuntarily committed for a 30-day period, and then their case is reevaluated for another 30 days. It can be up to 180 days. So you could say that there would be a wide range of how long somebody would be in the facility, depending on how long they were committed for. So it would just depend on their case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm generally supportive of this bill. The only concern I have is that, you know, that where the rubber meets the road kind of thing. The concern that I have is if you if this was being started in Fairbanks, I know they already have a list of people. Many of them are just, I'd say just, I'm not quite sure how to say some of this, are drunks that stumble around downtown and don't do a lot of harm, but the businesses downtown would just as soon see them gone. And I'm hoping that, you know, in the process that we sort this out and we are looking at those that are a danger to society and as well as themselves. And I realize those people are too, but they're not much of a danger to society. They're more a danger to themselves. And I hate to sound cold, but I guess if we're looking at making this successful and gaining support for this kind of thing, I think you want to get the danger to society off the streets as well, the ones that are that have a mental problem as well as a alcohol or a substance abuse problem and are potentially dangerous as the guy that killed the young woman in Fairbanks here not too long ago. So that's, I don't know if it's a question, it's kind of maybe more a statement anyhow. Thank you.
Through the chair to Senator Thomas, if I might, that's who we're talking about. The folks who are under a judge's discretion and judgment are a danger to themselves, a danger to others. Not the average run-of-the-mill public inebriate that are a constant nuisance to shop owners and tourists and the public in general, but we're talking about the worst cases that are truly a danger to themselves and others. These are people that are almost always substance abusers and mentally ill. It's a co-occurring kind of disorder, but we'd be using the substance civil commitment or involuntary commitment statutes with the most severe cases that are the most expensive and the most dangerous folks.
Thank you.
And Senator Thomas, through the chair, it would be our intention to really evaluate the results of this and look back when somebody gets committed to the 6 months or a year before they got committed. You know, what was their history? What was their utilization of resources? What were the social consequences of their behavior? And then be able to compare that to what happens when they leave the program. You know, only by that kind of rigorous evaluation can you really tell whether you're achieving the results that you set out to accomplish.
Senator Hoffman, you have a question.
Yeah, and with the, thank you, Mr. Chairman, with the language that's in the legislation or in the statement, the sponsor statement, do you envision that the people that would have priority under this program would be those pregnant women that have signs that they may be causing FAS?
Well, the one part of the bill does affect the other part of the bill. We, in all treatment programs, we're putting pregnant women at the top of the list. So yes, pregnant women would, if that were to pass, would have a priority for the involuntary commitment treatment capacity.
Senator Elm.
Thank you. A question, I think, for Mr. Jesse, and you've talked about the evaluation process, and I mean, one of the things that I hope is included in the evaluation process isn't just you know, what happens or what happened with an individual prior to the commitment and then what happens afterwards. I think it would be very helpful, especially to the Finance Committee, to try and evaluate also the cost effectiveness of dealing with of doing an involuntary commitment versus the cost that is accrued in public safety, the court system, and the correctional system also. So I guess I'm looking for confirmation that we're not just going to evaluate what happens to the individual, but we're also going to evaluate what happens budget-wise.
Well, through the chair, Senator Elton, to be honest, that's primarily what I had in mind. You know, obviously we're interested in the quality of life issues for the actual beneficiary. But frankly, there's not much doubt in our minds that a person who's sober in safe housing with productive activity is happier than somebody who's drinking themselves to death under a bridge. But, you know, we understand what this committee wants to know is, well, how do the numbers add up? Back to Senator Thomas's comment before, I don't think it's cold-hearted to look at those issues, because, you know, money that we spend inappropriately or unnecessarily on people in these other systems is money that's not available for other services that we really need. And so we need to look at those numbers. And the public inebriate under the bridge is not free. You know, there are huge cost centers around those individuals. The frequent utilizers in Fairbanks, you know, some of those people are costing $45,000-$50,000 a year. You know, there was an article in the New Yorker a while back called Million Dollar Murray. You know, they calculated one individual had cost the state of New York over $1 million over 10 years in all of these different services that they consume. You know, that is intolerable, and we have to look at the numbers, and we have to get a handle on these people that are creating these huge cost centers.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That brings up another question. After the program, if this is implemented after 3 years, what are the benchmarks for us to look at to judge whether or not this program is a success or a failure, and should it be continued? You know, are we looking at the potential savings of X amount of dollars per individual that you mentioned that had been identified, this one individual that costed that state $1 million?
Well, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I think what we'll be able to tell you is we'll be able to give you a pretty good idea financially what these people cost before they went into the program. You'll be able to see what the program cost to treat them, and we'll be able to show you the costs of aftercare. You will, of course, have to make the judgment as to how you think those numbers balance out and whether it's a good investment. Other jurisdictions have information that leads them to believe it has been a good investment for them. But until you see the numbers, I don't know that it's possible to predetermine just exactly what that threshold is going to be.
But Mr. Chairman, if I might continue, but what I think we would have to be judging is looking at the professionals. What was your expectations for this program, and were they met? You know, I think that we at this table are not the, you know, we have control over the state's checkbook, but the delivery of services and what is anticipated, I think is more a professional question.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, Senator Hoffman, through the chair. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think that one of the things in when we get to the program development phase of this is going to be studying those performance benchmarks so that we can have a target to aim at. If you don't have a target, you're never going to get there. That's true in human services as it is in business or anything else. So we'll have those benchmarks for you as we develop the program.
Okay. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wished I knew the answer to homelessness and the things that cost our society money. I just got to tell you, intuitively, this makes me very, very nervous. I mean, I have been affiliated with Operation Stand Down, and I mentioned the other day about homeless veterans and things of that nature. It is a syndrome that I still don't have my arms around mentally. Some of the characterizations I've listened to about how expensive they are, I mean, we have wanted number one, wanted number two that we're out there, and I got my Brizard that I'm out to police up the order of merit list. That's one part. The other part is I spent once upon a time in a former life a president of boards that looked at how you would dispose of people, whether they would go to in-home treatment sort of facilities, if you will. And I just remember the people, the professionals that talked about the success rate, there had to be consequences. And I've listened to the term, we're gonna protect these people for themselves. I don't think you can do that. I just don't think you can protect people for themselves. So intuitively, I mean, I wish I could stand up and cheer for this because I see there's a lot of passion for it. It makes me very nervous. And I'm suspect, I suppose, would be my point.
Okay. Do we have any other questions before we go to the next guest at the end of the table? Thank you. Thank you, thank you, Jesse. I'd like to bring forward now Lonnie Walters. Is she in the room?
He
in the room, excuse me. You don't look like a she, Lonnie.
Oh, no.
I just misspoke. If you could identify yourself, please, and who you represent, and speak to the bill, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, sir. My name is Lonnie Walters. I'm the chair of the Governor's Advisory Board on Alcohol and Drug Abuse presently. I am the co-executive director of a small substance abuse mental health facility on Craig and on Prince of Wales. I think the two most important qualifications I bring to this table, though, is I am a recovering alcoholic with 26 years sobriety now who was not under this law, but it was involuntarily committed in the military to an alcohol treatment center. The military doesn't go through all this stuff. They just say, you're going to go to a center, and that's the end of it, and you go. And that saved my life. And before coming to Alaska, I was an involuntary commitment specialist in the state of Washington. I did this. I involuntarily committed people. And the thing that kind of broke my heart when I came to Alaska is we had the involuntary commitment law, but we did not have a place to commit to. And I've actually committed people in the state of Alaska, and both of them walked out of the facility because it wasn't a secure facility. They didn't have a secure place to go to. In my career, I've probably committed about 30 people in the state of Washington. I would say, this is anecdotal, just roughly we had about an 80% success rate. Now we're talking about the high flyers of the frequent flyers of service. We're talking, our people had 6, 8, 10 detoxes. They had 30, 40, 50 arrests. The emergency room visits were pretty overwhelming. And I will tell you that once we got these people out of involuntary commitment, I did not have, now this, and I find this very, very emotional at times and very, very gratifying. We did not have one person that did not thank us for putting them there. I mean, really what we did was we saved their life. I truly believe that every alcoholic wants to quit drinking. I truly believe that now. I think I'll stop there and answer any questions if you have any.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was an expression, or there was a concern expressed by Senator Huggins. I guess, how do you answer that concern since you've been both in the military as well as civilian life to allay some of the questions that he has?
And through the chair, what was that question, sir? I didn't hear it back there.
The question, part of the question had to do with, and the part that I was paying attention to was kind of a rephrasing what Senator Hoffman said, which is, how do you go ahead and make sure that the effectiveness of the program eventually curtails or is to the degree where you can see it in society and how it benefited from it? Was that how you phrased it?
Okay, through the chair, Senator Olson. One of the overriding things about involuntary commitment is time. Mm-hmm. The more chronicity that you're dealing with, the more time it takes to recover. Mm-hmm. These normal 30-day programs do not work for these people. There's not enough time. In 30 days, their brain doesn't even clear up in 30 days. They need time. They need length. I will say this: of every drug and alcohol program I have ever been affiliated with, involuntary commitment gives you your biggest bang for your dollar. Did I answer your question, sir?
Yeah, to a certain degree. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, seeing then no other questions, we'll move on to the off-net. We'll go to Dr. Mark Pellicaro. If you could please pronounce your name correctly for the record, because I'm sure I didn't do a very good job, and who you represent.
Providence. I'm better than most people. It's Dr. Mark Pellicaro. Good morning.
Okay.
I received a copy of this bill about a month ago, and I've never sponsored a bill before, but upon seeing this, myself and Providence both support Senate Bill 100. And basically because it speaks of increased energy and resources and attention to people suffering from chemical dependency, and in particular, those with coexisting mental illness. I'm the medical director of the psychiatric emergency room at Providence. We're connected to the main emergency room, and we deal with basically psychiatric emergencies. 30% of my patients come to me by police. And we see about 4,000 patients a year just in our little area. And I can tell you the vast majority, approximately 70%, have at least some chemical dependency issue associated with their current situation, decompensation, et cetera. When patients come here, my job is to evaluate somebody, diagnose their acute emergent crisis, and then treat the treat what's ever going on emergently, and then refer them to the next best place to continue the road to recovery so they don't end up back involved with the police, so they don't end up back here in the emergency room. And I have some resources in town to do that. The number one lack of resources for me is for a detox for or treatment options for the dual diagnosis patient. And the dual diagnosis patient is the one with a legitimate mental illness plus a significant substance abuse chemical dependency problem. Probably the most difficult patients to treat in my business. There's literally 8 beds in town for all the hospitals to refer to in the emergent situations. And to get these patients better, the first step is to get them to a detox program in the surroundings of sobriety that both identify the chemical dependency issues and the mental health issues. And I guess that's my view in a nutshell, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you. Seeing no questions, thank you for your testimony. We'll go on to Margaret Lowell. Oh, if you could please introduce yourself, Ms. Lowell, and who you represent.
I am I'm a trustee on the Mental Health Trust, and I'm also speaking just as a long-term citizen of Alaska. I've lived in Alaska for a very long time, and I've seen the problem with substance abuse and alcohol addiction continue to increase and devastate lives of Alaskans. I've had a personal research project going on for the past 15 years, and virtually all of the instances of child abuse and neglect in all the cases that I've come to in many sort of different disciplines, I've never found one that does not have substance abuse as a part of the problem. And frequently that is the cause of the whole problem. I think improving life for the children of Alaska is cost effective and it's a moral responsibility. So another aspect to look at in terms of our children who are experiencing abuse and neglect due to caregivers, parents, et cetera, not being able to manage well and be reliable parents for their children. When I was Commissioner of Health and Social Services, we were beginning to be aware of the commonality of mental illness and substance abuse. And now we have established the Division of Behavioral Health to provide state-of-the-art treatment. We are in great need of much more treatment availability and treatment that is appropriate to each person and their personal situation, which again, pregnant women, circumstances of mothers of young children going into treatment and having treatment programs that are actually available and practical for each person who is in need of treatment. I remember testifying before legislative committees when I was commissioner and being asked why, with more money being appropriated all the time, the data showed that the problem was growing. I'll say today what I said then. We need to spend far more money than we are currently spending. We need to spend the money on treatment facilities and on personnel and personnel training as our basic approach to prevention. We look at prevention and often we think, well, we'll start to tell these children when they are in junior high or high school about the dangers and problems with using or abusing substances, including alcohol. I think that one of the best ways to do that kind of prevention is that children are in homes where parents have received appropriate treatment and are able to model the kind of wellness and appropriate behavior and children are in a place where they're not seeing the modeling of substance abuse. There are many other comments I could make, especially based on the those testifying ahead of me, but I will stay with this at this point. I know time is very valuable. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll come back. Senator Olson, you have a question before we come back to the room?
For Ms. Lowe, if I could.
Sure.
Ms. Lowe, I asked a question earlier on, as a former commissioner of Health and Social Services, why was not a program like this instituted earlier? And I see the benefits of it. Certainly the qualities are there, especially related to pregnant women, because you're dealing with two people in the next generation. I guess my question comes back to why wasn't a program like this implemented earlier?
Well, I think there were, Senator, I think there were, we've been implementing programs for many years, and I, again, money is not the whole answer by any means. Methodology and treatment are, and having evidence-based and well-determined treatment is extremely important, but I honestly have to say that we just have never put nearly enough resource into this. We just have not spent the money that we need to spend in order to deal with an overwhelming problem. And I think as far as state-of-the-art, we do, I think Alaska has done a good job of professionals and all sorts of personnel and families learning more and more about what seems to work and what are the most practical ways. And we have some very unique problems in Alaska in terms of people receiving treatment in centers, whether that's in the big cities or whether it's in the hub villages, and then going back, returning back to a village where there is maybe not the kind of support they need following treatment. And again, that's an expensive piece, but a very worthwhile piece.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Commissioner, thanks for your testimony. You've talked in your initial presentation and in response to the question, you talked about spending more money. I mean, I'm going to make an assumption, and I want you to confirm whether my assumption is correct or not. It is easy to run our finger down how much a program costs, but I'm assuming that if you do spend that money, there are savings associated with that. Is that presumption incorrect?
No, that presumption is extremely correct in that, I guess part of my response to you would be my comments regarding children and the expense. Just look at, say a very simple piece of that might be how many children have to be supported, taken in by, and supported by the Office of Children's Services, placed into foster homes, placed back, travel, many, many things like that where there are those costs, injury costs, emergency room costs, just an endless amount of, just a very simple one is how many fires are caused by people who are abusing and consequently not managing and burning down houses, et cetera. There's just no end to it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for your testimony. That would like to come back to the room. Ms. Linsmeyer?
Linsmeyer,
if you could come forward and state who you are for the record and who you represent, and that way I won't have to mispronounce your name and embarrass myself up here.
Well, that's why my name is Suey. We don't ever use that last name. My name is Suey Linsmeyer. I'm here as a parent today and somebody who cares about children and families. I guess I'll just get started. I wrote my stuff, so I don't write it, so I don't go off track.
What are you?
I'm here. I live in Juneau.
Okay. You could paraphrase your, if you want to, and then we'll can get copies of your written testimony for everybody, or?
Sure. I'm the mother of an alcoholic and an addict. It's been a long haul for me, and I heard about this bill yesterday, and that's why I came down, and when I got a chance to look at the full bill, I'm very impressed by it. I don't see one thing in there that I disagree with. I think it's a really good starting place for this state. because alcoholism is huge. It's everywhere. It crosses every boundary, including economics and social boundaries. My son struggled with drugs and alcohol for 7 years. He learned about drugs in the Juneau School District. He started using when he was 13, and he's not the only one. He's the same age as this boy here, who just yesterday, while he was drunk, supposedly committed a crime. I'm really thankful that this isn't my son. It could have been my son. He came to me, I guess 2 months ago, and said, I need treatment, and I need it now, and I need to get out of town. And thankfully, our family has health insurance. My husband works for the state, and his plane fare to where we needed to go, because we couldn't get a place in Alaska, and his treatment was covered by insurance. He went to a wonderful program that saved his life and the whole lives of all of our family. It was in Washington. It was a 21-day treatment program. In the state of Washington, if you commit a DUI or another crime that has to do with alcoholism or drug addiction, you have the option, unless it's something really bad like murder, you have the option of either going into treatment or going into jail. And a lot of people realize, I've got a problem, I've got to get help, so they choose treatment. And the program that my son was at had quite a few of those people there. It was a 21-day program, and we call it the ranch. It was really cool. Prior to that, I thought, oh, you know, this is his problem. I just don't know why he did this. I blamed it on the school system. I blamed it on everything else. Basically, alcoholism and addiction are a disease. And this is what they teach you in this treatment program. And where he went, it was a nonprofit program. It cost us $4,200 for 3 weeks of intensive treatment. It covered everything. It covered our family also to come and get family treatment on how to deal with this and to get the education and support that we need. It gave him the tools that he needed to re-enter society, to come back to Alaska, and to continue getting the support he needed. It made him believe that, yes, he has a condition that he cannot help, but he knows what he can do to get the help he needs. He attends AA every day. And if you guys have a question about what that's like, write down at the Catholic Church. They have 3 meetings a day. And those people are so committed, and they are the people that you're talking about. Those people have got treatment. They're the ones that have said, I'm not going to cost my family and my community and my employer any more money. I've got to get help. They got help somehow. It's very hard to just wake up one day and say, I'm an alcoholic, I'm tired of this, I'm going to go help myself. It just doesn't work. You need some sort of a treatment plan. So he goes to AA every day, he goes to counseling, and most of it has a sliding scale, so it makes it affordable for him. But he was facing going to jail or going to treatment, and thankfully we found an attorney that said, hey, I know of a really good program where you can go. Otherwise, he would be this kid who would go into jail, come out after 90 days, and continue drinking or doing drugs. We found out he has a mental, emotional problems, like everybody does. Unfortunately, somebody has, you know, social anxiety disorder or depression, or people have been dealing, maybe they didn't grow up in such a good situation and they're dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome from dealing with a bad foster care situation, whatever. Mental illness is huge. And for a lot of people, drinking and doing drugs is a way to kind of take the edge off of that. So I encourage you to look beyond just the people who sleep under the bridge and know that this is going to be really good for all Alaskans and all families.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll go on to the... It makes much more effective testimony to do what you did, just speak your mind, paraphrasing, and then giving the committee the written.
Thank you. I was just worried I would go on too long because I have a lot of opinions.
Oh, that's okay. I watched the clock above you. You're okay. You're okay. I'd like to go ahead and bring forward then the last person on the list, Werner Stillner. Mr. Stillner, if you could state who you are for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill.
Yes, sir. I'm Werner Stillner, a psychiatrist employed by Bartlett Regional Hospital and on the Governor's Advisory Board for Alcohol and Drug Abuse, as well as having lost two great-grandparents to alcoholism on a personal note. On a professional note, the weakness in our current system is that if we want to involuntarily commit someone through the alcohol statutes that exist at the present time, virtually all facilities will say no, especially for something that is a 30-day or longer commitment. Our current system does not accommodate for that, and there's a history for that. Secondly, if someone has a co-occurring disorder, in other words, an alcoholic with a bipolar disorder, that individual gets rejected. That would be like rejecting someone from the hospital for having diabetes and hypertension at the same time. We don't discriminate in the other area about that, but we do in the area of alcohol drug treatment. If someone has a co-occurring disorder, in addition to addiction, they are seen as not eligible for the program. Also, we have a system that doesn't function very well 24/7, which is included in this bill, especially in medical detox areas that prepare someone for treatment. Detox is nothing more than the preparation for treatment. Drying someone out does not really contribute much, except maybe it prepares the process for the next phase of treatment. And then finally, the rapid cyclers or the repeaters are currently recycling, taking up a good deal of time from police, from emergency room, from ambulances, from hospital beds, and we don't have a very good way of dealing with that. So I speak in full support of Senate Bill 100 with one modification that I'll get to later on. First of all, the notion of involuntary treatment. We have in mental health statutes that allow us to commit someone because they're gravely disabled. I think the alcoholic or the chemically dependent is at the time of addiction or intoxication gravely disabled and as eligible for commitment as the mentally ill. And people say, whoa, that doesn't work. You have to want treatment. From 35 years of experience in this field, that does not hold true. Treatment is as effective for voluntary patients as it is for involuntary patients. The literature points that out as well. So that's a false notion that someone has to come knocking on the door and saying, I want treatment for my alcoholism. That very seldom happens. Most of them come to us coerced for some reason because they're interested in preserving their state and not going into withdrawal. So the second part is that a secure detox is what this piece of legislation provides. Intense case management, which I think we're lacking, and treatment for the co-occurring disorder and for the repeater. Now, I think what this is designed to do is to divert from emergency services, hospital beds, the criminal justice system, Senator Elton, and we think that this is something that would have an immediate effect. I don't think, Senator Hoffman, I think we can quantify at this time how much money would be saved. But the moment someone is in treatment for 30 to 90 days, that individual is consuming fewer services from the agencies that we discussed. The only critique I have of Senate Bill 100 is that it has a pilot project, and I'd like to make that an S pilot projects. By the year 2012, if we wait for the data from this pilot project to institute something elsewhere, I think we've lost a lot of time and a lot of deaths to the number one public health problem in Alaska. And therefore, I'd like to propose that the Senate Bill 100 include three regional projects that would be able to compete against each other, learn from each other, and improve our entire system. So I think that I compliment Senator Ellis on putting this forth. I do think it would be better if it was a three-regional program of a pilot project rather than a single one. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any questions for Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Stillner, you may be more familiar with the situation than I am, but there was a situation out in Bethel when either you were out there or shortly before that where there was an involuntary incarcerate who was pregnant. Judge Curta got a fair amount of criticism from that when that happened. Were you supportive of him or not supportive of him?
Well, I can't tell you the specifics about that case, But I do think that there are times when involuntarily a treatment is the best treatment available. I think the argument there is that are you going to discourage other people if you make this a criminal offense for coming into treatment? That's been the traditional argument against involuntary treatment of pregnant women. But I think that you could make a public health argument for the fact that, as you pointed out, this is not only the life of the mother, but the life of another generation coming into being. So I think that there are times when that, in fact, is needed. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, one further question. As you looked at what happened out there, and certainly under title, some of the involuntary commitments that they've done where they've been challenged after they've gotten out, has that ever happened to you?
Never.
Never has. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And as Mr. Walters pointed out to me, I've had many people thank me for the fact that they were coerced into treatment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator Ellis, do you have any comments, or would you like to?
I do. I really appreciate you letting me present this. And this has been in my experience as sponsor of this legislation. People come forward that we haven't, you know, asked to testify, who of their own volition are supportive and excited about this approach. You know, it is really a public health emergency in our state. We've become inured to some of these horrible statistics, and people have thrown up their hands and said, you know, we'll just keep doing what we're doing because, you know, it takes something to move forward and try something different. What I'm proposing here is, I think, a very logical step. It's something like Jeff Jesse that I would not, even a few years ago, have proposed because of the civil liberty issues involved, but I think people in the profession and those of us watching this have decided to try something new. Mr. Chairman, I know that you, I've discussed with you and with the other co-chairmen and mentioned it to other members of the committee as well, the ability that we could, with a committee substitute, move ahead. And I would ask you to consider moving ahead with the popular, free, non-controversial portions of this bill, what I talked about in the first section. And I know this will be a disappointment to many, but I think it's realistic to ask the committee to take the pilot project, which I would like to see expanded too, but you know, it is a significant step even as proposed in this bill. But to set that aside as an interim project of the committee, and I would ask you all to program some time during the interim to think about this further. I would take that time, if this portion of the bill remains in the committee, to work with the Palin administration and with Carlene Jackson, and there's been a lot of interest there in this new Office of Behavioral Health that I think is working very well, to explore this, to take the time to convene a meeting of stakeholders with the Mental Health Trust Authority and other potential funders along with the state. So I'm proposing, Mr. Chairman, if you would consider a committee substitute that moves the non-controversial good part of the or free part of the bill forward, and sets aside the pilot project for further consideration over the next year. I'm going to try and convince the Palin administration to include these capital and operating expenses in their budget for next year and bring this back before the committee at a later time to see if we can move forward together. Because we do have to have buy-in and agreement by all the stakeholders for this to move forward and to be sustainable over time, and to get enough track record to know if it really is saving money and should be expanded in the future. I would love to see this in urban and rural Alaska. I believe that if we move ahead together, we will be able to see a cost savings. We'll wonder why we didn't do this years earlier, and that we will see an expansion in cost savings across the state. So that's my proposal to you. I hope that we can move the first portion of the bill forward and then take more time to think about the pilot project in the future.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Hoffman, may we have a motion for an adoption of a CS?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. We'll just take a brief at ease. Committee substitute bill. Sorry for getting out of order. Rambunctious. Senator Hoffman, if you can.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt committee substitute for Senate Bill 100, version R, dated April 16th, as our working document.
We have a motion to adopt a CS.
Mr. Chair, I just object for a comment.
Okay. There's an objection. Go ahead and comment to your objection.
Mr. Chair, I mean, I appreciate, I think, what the sponsor is trying to do, but I can't help but comment that, I mean, I think we are talking about a public health crisis. I think that it is important that we take a first step. I think it is important that we move ahead with a component of this. But I've just got to say that I do feel that I do feel that we need to take a big step. And I am more compelled, I think, to the notion that we expand the pilot project rather than that we take the pilot project out. I'm going to accede to the wishes of the sponsor, but I think that I would hope that one of the things that happens over the interim as we work with the different entities is that we not just talk about the pilot project, but we also talk about some of the other things that are happening within the system. For example, I am extremely dismayed, and I'm committed to working with the Commissioner of Corrections and with other people. I mean, it seems to me, and I don't use this word lightly, but it's maybe appropriate when we're talking about the correction system. I think it's criminal that we have people, the majority of the people in our prison system, that are there because of crimes they committed, because they're addicted, or because they were under the influence at the time the crimes were committed. And we've reduced the substance abuse programs within the prison system. So I think what we're talking about is extremely important. I don't think it's just a pilot project in this case and just talking about involuntary commitment. I think it's systemic. And I think that the demonstration projects, for example, that we've had in the court system with therapeutic and wellness courts have demonstrated success and have demonstrated that the money that we're spending on them is actually, I mean, it's so easy to run our finger down the cost column, and there is no savings column. But I think that we know and that we understand that there are savings. I just felt compelled to object to the motion to adopt the committee substitute, and I'm going to accede to the wishes of the sponsor because I think there is a certain amount of sense of working with all of the stakeholders to make sure that what we end up with is something that can best prove to, I don't think we need to prove to anybody that's sitting around this table that we need to do something. But I think maybe the benefit of what the sponsor is suggesting is that we can help prove to people outside this building and people that aren't sitting around this table that we need to move forward. But again, I regret that we're not taking this step, and I remove my objection, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Hearing no further objection, we'll go ahead and adopt the CS. I'd like to just add that as we go forward through the interim, that I agree with Senator Ellis working with the administration on this issue and even exploring the concept of having maybe three alternative sites or two alternative sites to try to have a little bit of competition to work out the best methodology. It'd be something to consider and talk about when we compare the cost-benefit analysis. You know,
appreciate that.
With this and we're still in the process of waiting for the new fiscal note on the CS. The original fiscal note actually had the pilot program in it. So we'll have a new fiscal note to catch up to the bill. Hopefully that'll be tomorrow as soon as we can get it done. So we're gonna go ahead and set this CS aside. Waiting for the completion of the updated fiscal note. I think tomorrow morning we have another bill, but we're out of time. The next bill up is Senate Bill 76. It concerns tuition savings plan for foster children. I think it would be beneficial that rather than move the next meeting back, that we stop at the scheduled time here at 10:30, take this bill up tomorrow morning before the Capitol bill. It will be then televised across the state. I think this is an important issue that we're dealing with children, and I think it needs to have more exposure than just a conversation at this table. So I'm going to take the leeway to postpone this 24 hours, and we'll take that up tomorrow. If that fiscal note's ready, we'll take that up first, followed up by Senate Bill 76, and then we'll move in to the capital budget.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I guess I've pretty much laid out tomorrow's meeting. We'll see everybody here bright and early at 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned.